Hall from the Summer School Office. And I'm here to introduce your speaker for this lunchtime lecture, Professor Ashwin Desai, for the lecture Reading Against the Grain, Ways of Seeing, Ways of Reading in the 21st Century. Professor Desai is the director of the Center for Sociological Research at the University of Johannesburg. He's sitting down there, by the way. He will appear in a moment. He has a master's degree in sociology from Rhodes University and a PhD from the University of Michigan in the USA. Previously, he was a researcher at the Center for Civil Society at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and a lecturer in journalism at the Durban University of Technology. Ashwin is a prolific and wide-ranging author with 8 books to his name, including on topics such as Indians under apartheid, community struggles in post-apartheid South Africa, several books on sport, including one entitled Blacks and Whites, about cricket, and most recently a book entitled Reading Revolution, Shakespeare on Robben Island. He has been recognized variously as a social commentator, an investigative journalist, an activist intellectual, as well as being a respected scholar in sociology. Today's lunchtime lecture, exploring ways of knowing, ways of seeing, and ways of reading, it seems like you'll get to hear Professor Desai in all these roles as an academic, a social commentator, an author, and an intellectual. And I know he's looking forward to engaging you with your ideas, so I'm handing you over to Ashwin.
Thanks so much, Janet. Let me just say about that I know Janet from the early 1980s. We were both at Rhodes together. And one of the inspirations for this topic is that experience in Grahamstown, where I arrived as a student, having come out of education in Durban, where my mother decided that I had to be first in the class. And the way you have to be first in the class, she sat next to me and I would write out essays, learn them by heart, and repeat them to her. And so by the time I wrote for a standard 6, I had known about 28 history essays by heart. And I also had learned 12 Ninth by heart. So I still know it, I think, 50 years later. It used to be the food of love, play on the answer, so that was speaking, but that was right in the city, and I still died. That's been again, they had a dying four. And there I arrived at Rhodes thinking, I would definitely get first. The first African history essay lectured by a Julian Cobbing, zero. Next African history essay, zero. Simply because I was just repeating what the textbook said, and I had no idea at the time that the history department of Rhodes University was engulfed in a huge war down the corridor between a guy called Jeff Perries and Julian Cobbing about whether the Infantkani really existed or not. And so it was the big debunking time of African history, and here I arrived, you know, sprouting nonsense. Of course, the debate was settled like all Rhodes University debates are settled. Jeff Perries ran off with Julian Cobbing's wife to the Transkei. Of course, it was kind of, you know, I was just thinking now because what the person in the podcast said, you know, she's been a PhD in media studies, and so remember, you know, you have this idea of this ferment and changing the world and so on. And there was a cartoon in the journalism department at the time, and it had Joel Mervis, who was the Sunday Times editor, asking a Rhodes student, so what experience do you have? And the student says, I have a journalism degree from Rhodes. And Joel Mervis says, we'll soon overcome that handicap. So this idea, one of the things that was given to us in this time of the 80s, by some of the most incredible lecturers, was this idea of debunking, of thinking critically, of trying to break boundaries, and trying to think about our practical experiences as speaking back as theory to the rest of the world. And so we had teachers like Jackie Cock, wrote this incredible book, Maids and Madams, which really changed the idea of what is labor and so on. And so, it obviously is something that also gets you into trouble. because you're constantly trying to ask a question and it almost becomes reflexive. And so when I saw this documentary, it says, Amar Katrada, you know, prisoner so-and-so of a strong mind. And at the bottom it says, the value of the documentary is that truth always, or good always overcomes evil. And I immediately want to say, ha, what are these guys meaning power now? You know, immediately doesn't really overcome evil, but once you assume power. And so, the kind of critical questions I want to ask today, I've first been gelled by going backwards in time, and that's what I'm going to talk about first. I used to lecture with a guy called Sunny Venkatratnam, who spent years on Robben Island in the single cell children of the prison. And we just chatted away, and one day I went to visit him after he'd long retired, and he brings out the Shakespeare, and opens the Shakespeare. And when I looked in, I was incredibly amazed. In these pages of Shakespeare, as the years went, different prisoners had signed off in sections that they loved. And the way he got that, Shakespeare, was it was confiscated, but his parents sent him Diwali cards. And they took porridge and they covered the Shakespeare with Diwali cards. And so he said it's his Bible, it was the Bhagavad Gita. And so through the years, you know, the different prisoners, some of the luminaries of our struggle, signed off. And they thought about it. Many just signed off. I mean, Stats Cooper said he signed off on Hamlet, the section, because all the good parts were taken. But you can see how much thought went into it. Mandela signed off on Caesar. Gogol and Mbeki, who loved music, signed off on Twelfth Night. Walter Sisulu, who was born of a white father and an African mother, signed off on Shylock, do I not also bleed? So these people thought about, because they had years in which to think about it and read it. And it started me to think about how they were reading text. And they were reading text according to their own situation. So it wasn't only Shakespeare that they were reading. For example, Robert Sobukwe, who lived Lear-like, as you know, on the island, cut off every other prisoner, was reading Arthur Klusner's Darkness at Noon, which was a critique of Stalinism at the time, because he was fighting the communists in a major battle. At other times, which is quite funny sometimes, people took his book so literally that Amar Katrada and his memoirs writes that while he was in solitary confinement in the dungeons, he was given Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, which, as you know, is about sickness. It takes place in a sanatorium and so on. And he writes that this is what has entered in his file. Many years later, when he came out of prison, he said, my persistent request to see a doctor must have prompted an entry in my prison file, which I came across years afterwards. And it quotes, Amar Katrada is just a frustrated man who has lost his objectivity and is lodging of all kinds of petty complaints instead of accepting his position and trying to make the best of it. And he says, the worst part is he started to think like Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain. He started feeling these illnesses, and sometimes they took this literally. Of course, often the ignorance of the warders acted as a bonus for prisoners. Because, for example, Neville Alexander, who tragically passed away last year, but who is a professor at UCT, managed to get all the trilogy of Isaac Deitch's story on Trotsky, the biography of Trotsky, because it had things like The Prophet Armed. And the Afrikaans warders thought these were books about religion, and they let them in. They let in Marx's Capital, thinking it was about finance, if we can convince these guys to shape of communism. They let in Frederick Engels, Origins of the Family, because they thought Engels, English, is fine. So there were these things that were taking place. But for me, what was so powerful about the literature and about Shakespeare and the way they debated Shakespeare and the way they thought through Shakespeare was to open their minds to the world. They didn't read it reflexively as a text of a Eurocentric text. And it made me start to reflect on my own way of reading, own way of understanding. The other books that they would have would be John Steinbeck's Groups of Wrath, Jack London, The Iron Heel, Zola's Germinal. And so these books became a basis of debate across party political lines. And the other sort of juxtaposition for me between these two things was in close quarters. Here were warders who were supposedly locking up people because they were uncivilized, barbarians, childlike, who needed to come up to speed. And these people were seeking to learn, to dream a big and beautiful and wonderful world outside. While supposedly the superior race couldn't be bothered to read these books, couldn't be bothered to get an education. And it showed that juxtaposition between warders and those they locked up. But in the book, in Grainfielders, and I'll try to follow prisoners who are still alive and ask them why they signed off on these sections. And it was one of the most incredible experiences in one's life. One of them was Kredi Nkalipi, who you might hear if you see the documentary. I met him in the APLA offices in Mowbray. And I just wanted to ask him about Macbeth that he signed on, the one on A Lady Macbeth, all the perfumes in Arabia would not make this hand smell better, something like that. And so I'm in there just wanting one line and one comment from Mr. Nkalipi. And there are people coming in from Gugulethu, from Langa, and they're all greeting me with such respect. And I think, what is going on here? You know, I'm just here for one comment. And finally I said, you know, comrade, you know, I just wonder why these people all coming and bowing down and greeting. He says, you know, I didn't want to disabuse them, but they all think the mythical leader of the PAC in Cape Town is one Barney Desai. And they all thought that I was the son coming back from exile to tell the real story of the PAC. I also didn't disabuse them until I got the story. But it was one of the most humbling things to listen at the feet of people who spent so many years on Robben Island and start to listen to how they were thinking through Shakespeare, how they were thinking through literature, and how they were rereading them in the context of their present conditions in the island. Of course, I got so carried away by this text that I must add a footnote that Sunny Venkatratnam is not a member of the ruling party, and he's a very critical person. He comes from Abdusa, a small offshoot of what was the Unity movement. And so he started the Shakespeare, everybody got interested in it, I wrote the book, it gets taken to the British Museum, it gets put on display at the British Museum, he gets to go to London and so on. And he's really been very critical of what is going on in South Africa and his own experiences and so on. That the ANC, through the voice of Jackson in Tembo, if you go on their website, has put a statement out condemning the book and condemning the fact that Shakespeare wasn't very important. Once they did that, I knew I was on the right track, because the real part of the book for me, we all do things because we have our own little personal interests. The real part of the book for me, and the importance of the book for me, was writing what I call the sixth act. Because the most powerful Shakespeare for liberation fighters, anywhere in the world, especially in the so-called third world, was The Tempest. Because The Tempest was reread as if Caliban comes to power and he dislodges Prospero. And Prospero is the evil authoritarian. And so Rob Nixon writes that the problem with The Tempest, it lacks a sixth act. What happens when the Calibans come to power? And there, the liberation fighters are all aghast because that means turning a torch on them. And so in the opening chapter, I do say that what then of the record of South Africa's Calibans in power? Have those traditions hold on the island come to seize those who command political authority? How and why do we dispose of our own Caesars and resist the urgings of rank ambition by our own witches and wizards cooking up cauldrons of toil and trouble? And in the last chapter, I attempt to draw, if Shakespeare was alive, how he would write the sixth act when the Calibans come to power. And I will talk a bit about that at the end of this talk. So why then, against that background, am I wanting to talk about ways of seeing and ways of knowing? And why do I tell students at UJ who sit there, a thousand of them, I don't know why they do sociology, this mad mania to get into university and get a certificate, who come from education where they haven't really had to read a book, and try and talk to them, how do you have a critical perspective? And so one of the reasons for that is that how we read in the 21st century is a very difficult thing, because how knowledge and information is constantly and persistently changing before our eyes. And who controls knowledge? People say knowledge is power, but power is knowledge. Who determines what becomes knowledge in the public domain? And I try to tell them this through three seminal texts that shows how society and the ability for what becomes in the public domain to be dominated by certain interest groups through three wonderful books, which you won't get in the MBA of South Africa. The first, of course, is Vance Packard. Vance Packard, he was a sociologist in the 1950s, writes this book called The Hidden Persuaders. And basically, it was the first time of supermarkets, and he was called in by supermarkets to say, how can we sell our products? And he does all these experiments that are incredibly fascinating at the time. And the way he does it, he gives people washing powder. Three washing powders, blue, red, and white. And the red one is double power, washing powder. And housewives take them home, and they come back and he asks them, which was the best washing powder? All say the red one with double power. Of course, they're all the same washing powder. You can't sell the Maribuses, and they're 3 rand each. And you put them at the front, falling out for 10 rand. And people buy them because everybody's looking for a bargain. So he was the kind of originator of this idea of trying to get into people's minds, what moves people, and so on. But the way this idea of knowledge has moved is that the next book of this is John Ritzter, called The McDonaldization of Society. And he says the next step in all this was how McDonald's starts to take over, and they start to think over branding and knowledge and using our perceptions to their advantage. And believe it or not, that in order to own a couple of these McDonald's, you have to do a degree. There are two McDonald's universities, one in New Zealand, one in the States, and you get a degree in hamburgology. And if you look at the manual of McDonald's in John Ritz's fantastic book, it tells you, for example, the packet is cut halfway so that the chips fall out, so you think you're getting more for less. The stripes at the back of the packet are meant to create the illusion of more. Then less, that how the whole product gets shifted so they have less cost. So one of the great costs in America was labor. So immediately you go to the McDonald's, men do what they never do at home. You clean up after yourself. Then it was garbage, and then they have the drive-through, so you take the garbage home. And so you have less cost. So this idea of trying to develop some kind of idea of society has reached its height, its acme, in Martin Lindstrom's book, Biology and Now Brandwashed. And what he's saying in Brandwashed and Biology is that he works for Gap and he works for these big companies. And he's saying that companies have far out surpassed universities in how they get knowledge. And he starts from the basic by saying that they had people outside a supermarket that said, drink these cool drinks. One was Pepsi, one was Coke, but they were unbranded. 7 out of 10 people liked the Pepsi because of the sugar content. But when they knew the brand, they liked the Coke. That ended up now is that they have people who are under MRI scans, seeing what triggers what in the brain to understand what kind of knowledge that people will have about a product and what will motivate them to buy a product. That he talks about how the supermarkets now have trolleys that go around, but they have sensors in the trolleys that say where you stop, which aisle you first go down, where do your eyes go to first, at what level, and that they're accumulating this knowledge all the time, and they're trying to create a product and an industry all the time. That every time you get this Clicks card or Dis-Chem card and so on, it's for a reason, because they're saying what kind of product you want to buy. And they will give you those as special offers. So outside of this university construct, there's a whole set of knowledges that are starting to take place, that are starting to be developed as what becomes a way of knowing the world. And so some of our most
brilliant academics have been stitched into this kind of system in which we are involved in the development of what is false knowledge, of fraud, of lies, and many senior academics are involved in this. What does this mean? George Bonbier writes an article that there are pharmaceutical professors who test to the efficacy of drugs and put in the British Journal of Medical Science because they get paid £500,000, but the drugs have not been really tested, but they're professors. That all across our disciplines, the way our knowledge comes to bear in the classroom is dictated often by knowledges that are produced for money and for commodification. And I just bought a book now, and he's just a brilliant writer, Ben Goldacre, called Bad Palmer. But he's written a book called Bad Science, and it just rocks your mind about what we think is science, the basis of science, and so on. And so, how the world starts to change before us, and how knowledge starts to be developed, means the way we read society, the way we come to understand society, has to constantly be changing, more acutely critical. So, for example, one of the greatest books written on reading and seeing has been John Burns' Ways of Seeing. The other, Edward Said's Culture and Imperialism. The Way of Seeing, probably one of the greatest books of seeing sport, has been C.L.R. James' Beyond the Boundary. He changed the way we look at cricket. What is cricket? Right? This is not a game. So, if we have to look at cricket today and look at the fundamental changes it had taken from C.R.R. James, in reading C.R.R. James then and now, that he saw it as a national game for national liberation. Today, cricket is a global game. We have the cosmopolitan cricketer who doesn't need his country, like Chris Gayle or Kevin Prittison, who can de-link that so quickly a game from 5 days went to 50 overs to 20 overs and become privatized into personal ownership. So to think that you can watch a game as if it's a game without understanding how it's fundamentally changed in terms of power, in terms of who watches, in terms of the fundamentals of the game, by reading only C.R.R. James, you will be caught out literally and figuratively. So let me tell you a bit about this knowledge. I was quite surprised about Kindle, since we're talking books. E-readers can now tell us how long it took to read a novel on Kindle. If in fact you finished it, and if not, where you stopped, how many pages you read in an hour, where you bookmarked the page, etc. Instead of putting stickers to highlight the parts you want to note down, a leaf or flower on the page, the e-reader can highlight and save these excerpts. They then can index and search for electronically. The most popular highlighted sections are made available as contemporary cultural soundbites. 1984 is the 608th most highlighted book that Emerson sells. Who controls the past? Grand party slogan controls the future. Who controls the present? Controls the past. Was marked by 349 Kindle users. While if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a face forever has been highlighted by 195. According to Amazon, the top three highlighted books on Kindle are The Bible, Steve Jobs, and Hunger Games. This detailed information on our reading habits is then relayed back to publishers and writers, blurring the lines of why writers write and should they be responding to the reader's whims. Some might argue that this gives the reader power to influence what is written or read. What it doesn't impart is that the particular stage in our life when we read a particular book and the effect it might have had. What mood we were in, or why is it that when we return to certain books at a later stage, they often no longer hold the same resonance. The infiltration into our reading habits reduces them to facts without emotional or personal context. So do authors write for themselves, the reader, or the market? In Keep the Absolute Distance Flying, Orwell's main character, Gordon Comstock, bookseller and struggling writer, muses, "For after all, what is there behind it except money? Money for the right kind of education, money for influential friends, money for leisure and peace of mind, money for trips to Italy. Money writes books, money sells them. Give me not righteousness, O Lord, give me money." Orwell had an uncanny ability to capture the horrors of the future.
Most terrifying is novel 1984 with its double speak and its portrayal of dystopia. The female character Julia works for Pornsec, which turns out pornographic material for the masses. There was a whole chain of separate departments dealing with proletarian literature, music, drama, and entertainment generally overload. Here were produced ravishing newspapers containing almost nothing except sport, crime, and astrology, sensational 5-cent novelettes, films oozing with sex, and sentimental songs which were composed entirely by mechanical means. It could have been right for the media in 2013 would sell similar ideas of perfection and sex. How has the dumbing down of society affected the way we read, the way authors write? Tariq Ali tells us, indigestion and an excess of wind are no longer the preserve of the stomach. Just like rival hamburger concerns advertise the respective wares, so the giant publishing concerns of North American Britain buy authors and exhibit them like cattle. Potential bestsellers are auctioned by a new breed of literary agent. Such books need to be sold, and it is at this stage that the hype merchants enter the fray and the promotion begins. Is it particularly surprising, then, that in the face of today's prevailing winds, many a European or North American novelist has subconsciously or consciously begun to write in a language of advertising? Mass market, like the indigestible filler in junk food, is meant to be consumed quickly and then excreted. Don't misunderstand me. Good books, even great books, are still being written. And some, believe it or not, are even being read. But in most cases, these are the products of writers who either live in the marginalized countries or themselves being marginalized with the dominant culture of the triumphant West. More and more, one finds oneself rereading old books if one wishes to recapture the critical tradition. End quote. Publishers and writers. This is an old lover's quarrel. The bitterer on the writer's side, because ours is the greater dependency. Lord Byron, for instance, received an extravagantly printed Bible as a gift from his publisher, John Money. Byron sent the Bible back to Money with a single intimation. At John 1840, when the King James Bible read, "Now Barabbas was a robber," Byron had changed the text to read, "Now Barabbas is a publisher." The point that I'm making there is that what I was just reading, the Heart of Darkness, and just the way I would have read it in the turmoil of the 1980s, as a piece of colonial writing that sees Africans as barbaric and inhumane. And when you reread the text from this vantage point, and you think about society, and you think about Kurds, and you think about the subtlety, the nuance of the writing, what he was penetrating, the style, the ability to get to the depths of colonialism, how quickly you reread it in a completely different way. And then when we think about the seminal texts of our lives, like what the Robben Islanders were reading, and just think about the new texts that are meant for consumption, for Booker Prizes and so on, you can see why there's this idea that even things like literature are not exempt from this great urge of commodification. And we can discuss it a bit. So, I want to end by saying, what then I think of the present? What then do I think about reading Shakespeare into the 21st century in 2013? What of the present of the Calibans who have now have power? In reading through the documents purporting to spark a second transition, a second democratic revolution, one cannot help but think of Orwell's definition of doublespeak, and I quote, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. Where there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhaustive idioms. Our ruling class somehow cannot find the words, the language to explain themselves. Each new catchphrase exposes their poverty. The latest scandal, of course, is in Kampala, where 206 million rand of state funds is purported to have spent on upgrading the presidential palace. The report, however, cannot be made public because the renovations are issues of top security. One cannot but hear the words of W.H. Auden,
The ogre does what ogres can, deeds quite impossible for man. But one prize is beyond his reach, the ogre cannot master speech. About a subjugated plain, among its desperate and slain, the ogre stalks with hands on hips, while dribble gushes from his lips. Thomas Mann tells us in Dr. Faustus, life's more interesting phenomena, replied, probably always has this Janus face towards the past and the future. They reveal the ambiguity of life itself. This is the paradox and the power of the ANC. The ability to look two ways at once, modernization and traditionalism, nurturing the black bourgeoisie and uplifting the poor, African nationalism and non-racialism, anti-imperialism and the most craven genuflection to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Right now, this ANC is personified in the figure of Jacob Zuma, who straddles the urban and the rural, the traditional and the modern, the Robben Islander who can draw on revolutionary credentials to demand discipline, patience, and sacrifice in the present. While Zuma might have won a landslide among Guam, the splits and strains inside the alliance fester, and beyond the lines, sporadic upsurges get more insistent, more challenging, and spread from deep underground to the farmlands and urban communities. Despite the most plaintive calls to discipline and obedience to the party line, discontent grows. Uneasy lies ahead that wears the crown, Shakespeare tells us of the usurper Henry IV. Zuma cuts an increasingly Macbethian figure. Terry Eagleton tells us, having become king officially by killing Duncan, he, Macbeth, finds that he has achieved nothing. There's always another step to be taken before he's really king. Secure in his role, and each step taken undoes what he has won, because each step brings more destructive consequences. He's not allowed to become what he is, to be authentically king. He spends all his time and energy in consolidating his position. End quote. The Gospels that inspired our quest have been turned upside down. Now we're told that the Good Samaritan must first check if the injured Jew has medical aid. Jesus divides the fishes and bread and sells them to the highest bidder. He cannot cure the lepers because of financial constraints. Dare not turn the tables on the moneylenders at the risk of offending the markets, and preaches that forgiveness of debts and transgressions only encourages inflation and fundamentalism. Mandela's long walk to freedom is timed by the toll road. Our thirst by the water meter. Our desires by technocrats in straitjackets preaching mantras of discipline while they speculate our futures on the false cause of deregulation and foreign investment. What is a pilgrim to do? Thank you.
So I don't know where this goes from here, but you can make your speeches now.
Are you asking
yes.
Not for me.
Oh. Judges only pronounce, they can't ask questions.
What is it about reading that is so influential? What would you say?
Yeah. Look, you know, I'm what is it about reading that is so influential? You know, I was invited to the Reading Association of South Africa, which is just a fantastic group of people. My idea is that reading in itself is not, you know, because you know, we know that in Germany, of high culture, while they're listening to Mozart and have beautiful universities, you know, they turn a blind eye to, you know, the Holocaust. You know, so there's no relationship, often, can't be between the two. It's how we develop the ability to bring our own experiences to bear on the text, how we're able to both understand the beauty of language, not only be critical. Like Neville Alexander, he signed off on the sonnets. And asking why the sonnets, it's just the beauty of the language. It didn't have to have political meaning. You know, it was there under the worst conditions. So, but then, you know, Vargas would say, you know, just that reading allows us to travel, to be something that we're not, to be global, to escape the confines of the prison of our lives in which we find ourselves. And reading can do that. You know, not much else can do that. You know, and that's why it remains such a powerful thing. And but that's why the McDonald book is good. I mean, it's the McDonaldization of universities, right? That what many of you people are taught in universities. I'm sorry, they have been taught utter rubbish at those universities. The lecturers themselves haven't read books because what they've done is they McDonaldized it.
You can go through the whole of the university without having visited the library. Because we've got these courses, the massification of education that we all supported means you just get these, you read 10 articles that I set up, and you reflect on those articles. So we're actually getting a dumbing down rather than an expansion of this kind of critical sort of reading and the ability to have a read a whole book. You can do a 3-year degree and you don't have to read a whole book. And we know that with students, right? The minute they get in, they're doing fantastic books, Othello, they're never going to read commentaries like C.R.R. James on Othello or something like that. They're just going to read the Coles notes and they're able to get away with it. How we redevelop that, you know, is another story. But it's still a central weapon for the open, beautiful, debating society.
What was the name of the
Brandwash book? Brandwash. It's quite a remarkable book. This guy is...
Martin
Lindstrom.
L-I-N-D-S-T-O-R-S.
Yeah. You can see how much I enjoyed it.
What's the surname?
Lindstrom. L-I-N-D-S-T-R-O-N. He's got two books, Biology, B-U-Y-O-L-O-G-Y. Biology, and then six companies used to manipulate our minds and persuade us to buy. People know this. I didn't know that, you know, all the outfitting shops have changed their sizes. So that you have the sense that what was 38 now is a 36 because it makes us feel that we're slim and we can get into these. I had no idea. That size itself had changed over a period of time.
But that's true. America
is
actually like that.
Yeah, I mean, he puts it out here, and I'm thinking, my God. He's writing about across the world because he actually works for these companies and and across the world he's got all these things. And I mean, the idea of this accumulation of knowledge and this idea of what we're going to think next and how to even develop that is quite, you know, something. But obviously the other great guy in all this, I mean, I haven't read this book, but I mean, he's just the joy. He's Ben Goldacre. He's a medical doctor. He's written Bad Medicine, which, by the way, is on sale outside. But I mean, he just explodes the medical, you know. I can regale you with stories about what goes on in the classrooms of our universities and why the students are being churned out knowing very little or if not the wrong things. Yes?
Have you read The Feminine Mystique lately?
Not lately.
Well, of course. That's where it all comes
from. Yes.
And how many years ago?
Yeah.
How women were brainwashed into giving up their minds.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
you could have fooled
me. I mean, the McDonald's paradigm is now being shunned. You know, it became what John Ritzer writes in his book. It became the model of everything. You know, so casinos. When you go to casinos, you don't have clocks, because the time shouldn't be anything. They don't have windows, so you feel okay. Except for one in South Africa, the ATMs never take deposits. You know? Or the Virgin Active, this idea that you go there to relax, but they've got robots that control you. You know, some of us between physiologies. Why should you go there 20 minutes? And you always go to the you know, what John survives, you always on the treadmill overlooking the ocean or the swimming pool that you running into, you know, thing in the middle of Durban summer. I mean, Virgin Active as a sauna. You know, I mean, we should be having an ice cream, but it's this model, right? That in McDonald's, the patty is the same all over the world. It must just stick out of the bun because the vendors have this obsession, you're getting more for less, right? And they actually have these models of things. But that model has now been completely overtaken, you know, by just these new developments that are taking place at Lindstrom, you know, talks about. But my interest is this knowledge that is located somewhere else. Yes?
You're a bit critical of the university. What do you think of physical change as a past one for the group?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example. No. I'm critical of universities. What do I think about the 30% pass mark in matric? You know. Let me start with the university. One of the things about the universities is that the way the major funding comes to the university is through publishing. Not through So a lot of the good teachers have been taken out of the classroom to publish. So not unlike schools where they have something called a master teacher, where you don't have to become the principal. We're evacuating a lot of our classrooms of quite fantastic lectures and so on. The net result of this 30% is that when people are coming to university, we are having to completely lower the standards. There is a mania about lectures being under pressure to pass people. So I had four masters and two PhD students, and eventually I showed my dean that all I was doing was doing checker changes for English. And now, instead of saying maybe we should think about how we bring students in with a prior test, he said, I'm going to give you a whole lot of money, you don't worry about the English, I'm hiring somebody to do that for you. You know, because he was also under pressure for a turnaround time, because the minister is saying, what? Students have been here for 4 years, you haven't given them a master's degree yet. Racist, colonialist, leaders, sitting standards that are, you know, beyond the ken, you know, so, you know, there is a pressure. There is a pressure because we are picking that up. And you know, for me, the students will do anything. I know students have come to UJ who want to do engineering, but they want to do anything at the university and they end up doing catering. If long as they're in the university. And there is a mania, and you can understand. Some people, their families, grandparents, they're the first people to get a matric pass that can come to university. But we ourselves are not starting to do the prior work about who's suitable, what kind of courses we can offer, how even changing the courses. I mean, sociology, we are still teaching the sociology of trade unions, the labor process, and those kinds of things, right? As if this is a country of work. We have no sociology of no work. What do people do who don't work? You know, we have no understanding of survivalist economics. We have no idea of survivalist families. We have no idea of these things. And we're producing students who have no idea because we are lecturers born of the 70s and 80s. We're still photocopying our reading list from Rhodes in 1981 and giving out to students. Who cares about the labor process and Harry Barnum and labor monopoly capital? Our manufacturing industry is down into the dumps.
Well, change it then.
Oh, if you think the ANC and the Stalinists are heavy, try and tell an academic that he might just be wrong. Academic freedom! I mean, some of my colleagues lecture are so old, you can actually see the kind of yellow snot from 3 years ago. But you can't tell them. Because they have a comfort zone. Who polices academics? You know, I'm sure people who know the law will tell you. Just look at the law lecturers.
I've got to start way before the
say?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. School levels
should be integrated into university. You know, I just integrated into schools. It's so horrific. You know, it reminds me of the horror of the horror. I just don't even think about schools. They just...
Children aren't learning enough books. I don't read diverse electronic games.
Yeah.
Is it better for them to read rubbish than to read nothing at all?
Yes. You know, at least we have the discipline of focusing, you know, reading. And also, there's a challenge for us. I was criticized the way I wrote this, this book, by my peers. Because I really wrote it with as little footnotes as possible. And with a language that I thought could be beautiful for people. And a lot of people sort of, you know, snipped at it because it wasn't, where was sociology, where's Max Weber? You know, and where was Marx and so on, you know. So it's called The Reading Revolution of Shakespeare on Robben Island. Yes.
Could I return to the Shakespeare
question? Yes, of course.
How it is that people on Robben Island signed off on a Shakespeare. Did you have one copy of the book and each one signed at a particular point?
Okay. Firstly, I'm so glad you brought me back to this. I went to the Midlands Literary Festival in Harvick. And I was going to speak, but just because I'm a Catholic, and I also speak my book a little bit uncomfortable as a man who spent 27 years, who am I, and so on. So I spoke on something else, which is what I do often, and this lady caught up and she said, I'm 80 years old, and I gave up my whole afternoon, and you haven't even mentioned Shakespeare, you're an embarrassment. Okay, I'll answer that in two ways. You know, firstly, there's a mythology that's been created about Robben Island, and I just don't know if people even know South African history. There was the single section of 30 prisoners
at most, often more than just 32 prisoners, who had no contact with the thousands on the other side, right? And when asked to name people who were on the other side, who spent 20, 30 years on Robben Island, many can't, because they've been written out of history, right? Those voices. So he was in the single cell of the prison. And the interesting thing of that single cell was that it had the different political tendencies. There are a number of black consciousness guys who came in the 70s. They had these guys from the unity movement, including people like Neville Alexander. They had the old Rivonia tribes. So they were in such close proximity that he would lend one and then say, when you finish reading, can you sign off which one you liked? So it was over the 7 or 8 years, there was this accumulation of signatures. And I mean, it's just a fantastic story. And it's one of the most valuable Shakespeares in the world. Sonny Beckett Rotham lives, you know, it's almost semi-poverty, but he will never part with it. He gave it to the British Museum, it's coming back to him. Because it's all he has here. And you know, he when I asked him, and these people have such agile minds, I said, you know, what about, he said, well, you know about the disguise, because he's still good at the body cuts, covering it, he's still got that cover. And he said, it reminded him of, you know, the line from 12th Night, what country is this friend? And Viola assuming the disguise of a man, so you'd be able to live with the same principles, but in a disguised fashion. You know, he saw his Shakespeare is reminiscent of that. So that's how the signature took place.
Thanks. Could you spell the name of the man who's got that book?
Okay. Sonny, S-O-N-N-Y, and then Venkat Ratnam. V-E-N-K-A-T-H-R-A-N.
Exactly 100 years later, I mean, there were three or four different strikes in 1910. You know, so we also have to learn a lesson in history. So immediately you think about history, immediately Sharpeville. No. You know, the former liberation fighters, way back in the first part of the 20th century. I mean, Yasmats used aircraft to bomb white workers. Used aircraft. He actually, in 1913, the white miners' strike in 1930, he got the strike leaders to be deported. And the captain of the ship on the Umgeni said, you can't deport them because there's no law. He deported them and then he passed the law retrospectively. I'm just wondering about telling the story in case Zuma hears me. But just look at false capitalism and black economic empowerment. Just think about the historical analogies we have and think about how the oppressed learn so quickly from the oppressor. Yes.
Half of us will tell you that life is very difficult, and it's particularly difficult to adjust to the change as we age. All the things have changed. What is interesting is that younger people are saying, like you are now, we need change. How do we do it? In fact, the part of the wonderful Shakespeare, which of course I frequently read in the British Museum, and it is that when you look back on someone like Second Isaacs, I don't think.
Yes, of course.
And the second was heavily involved at the time they created in Robben Island. They tried to stop their football. I don't think anybody's seen the little film. And so on, they battled and fought and eventually overcame them, convinced those authorities that they needed to do that. We're in that kind of time. Our children.
Continues study and gets a PhD and becomes the head of informatics at Grootes Team.
And how does he get it? I get a letter, and I tell it's so easy. I get a telephone call from someone in the Black Sector, I can't remember who it was. I was at that time in that good skill. Will you see Seti Isaacs? He can't find work. Seti moved.
Sure.
He couldn't think, trust me, for years, he was selling eggs to make some money. Came into Kutskia, and within 10 minutes, I have spoken to him, phoned the security police, who were threatening him and saying, you may only work in an office where you're the only person working in the office. And we would work like that. So I said, you come onto Kutskia's premises, you have to inform us. And so he came, and yes, as you just said, he came and started the computer section, and he himself got a PhD and so forth.
Look, I mean, Alan de Botton in his book Religion for Atheists. And one of the things, you know, just being critical of people who, on the left, you know, austere, holier than thou, boring, and so on, and how they don't have a language, they don't have a style, they don't have the sense of humor, they don't have the sense of making critique sexy, you know, and youthful, you know, it's preached and so on. And how, you say, how often the churches, you know, are so powerful at having these symbols and so on that generate a sense of identity. So it's quite incredible. So there's a lot to do with us, you know, what do we do in the classroom? Somebody will ask me, you know, what do we do at the university? How are we challenging people? How are we changing things? How are we standing up to both keep our academic autonomy, but at the same time, incredibly guilty,
self-critical about it. I mean, we've got the textbooks in physiology teach people that a balanced diet is two eggs and orange juice in the morning. I mean, come on. You know, come on. You know, I mean, you know. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. If it is, okay, or diet, right? Yeah, I'm just thinking, no, I was thinking about this thing about diet, and I read this thing.
Who's
that?
Who produces that?
Yeah? Sorry?
Who produces
this
article?
Oh, it's, no, this is not to do with that, I'm not justifying that article. I said, it says 12 million people going to bed hungry, it's all that. The idea of what is a diet, what is a basic diet, what is food, this guy Damon Thompson, you know, writes about Patrick Crawford. We all knew Patrick Crawford until I read sort of what Patrick Crawford. Yeah, it's just complete hogwash. You know, I've been quite trying to throw those books away. So it's, you know, I mean, we do face dangers of this intrusion of money, big pharmaceutical companies and so on into the research agenda. We do face that into the university. And the universities on the other hand are encouraging us to open up to that and to keep looking for the grants, to keep trying to pay our own way and so on. So these are dangers that's taking place even at the level of research. Yes, sir?
Just to place on record when there's a session of lectures of this course, your colleagues at UCT and other universities do a lot of research with cities to ensure better food supply.
Yeah.
It's not all doing that.
No. I'm also part of research. Yes, you're right. There's a lot going on in South African Academy too. A lot of great things, and a lot of spaces for people to still do quite fantastic research and to influence policy.
I think you should get superior on this topic.